Well, it's hard not to be completely captivated by these images of Gazans dancing on the streets, celebrating, some of them being pulled out of tents in their temporary accommodation to be told a peace deal has been agreed between Israel and Hamas, that the hostages are to be handed back and that the fighting will stop, Jerry.
Yes, I think it's an extraordinary day, and we did predict that it was possible. And look, there's a lot to come, but in a way that doesn't matter. Of course, there's a lot to come. Just to get to this day, I think is an extraordinary event.
Welcome to this emergency episode of Global Roaming. We're coming to you in the hours immediately after the news, which emerged initially from the United States, with Trump posting on Truth Social saying that Hamas had agreed to the initial terms for phase one of this peace agreement. Then shortly afterwards, the Qataris, which had been key mediators in the whole thing, their foreign ministry announced via the foreign ministry spokesman that it was confirmed. Then Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, announced that he was welcoming this news and that it was all to go before the Israeli cabinet for ratification.
Yes, I mean, it's quite interesting to follow through on some amazing remarks by President Trump. Everyone's liking me now. It's amazing, he said. But he actually did say on tape, I said to Benjamin, to Bibi, Israel cannot fight the world, Bibi. They can't fight the world. Now, that was a very interesting little grab. Suggest, you know, it just makes you wonder how much he did have to really heavy Netanyahu.
The world rightly questions Trump. His motives, his actions, his approach, sometimes bemoans it. Mm. Is there something about Trump's personality, his desire, his ego for the Nobel Peace Prize, for outcomes, to show that he can seal the deal? Is there something about him that has enabled this moment, do you think, Geraldine? Do you give him credit? Must we
take stock right now and say, okay... Definitely you've got to give Trump credit. I mean, I still believe that when the history is written, I think we'll probably find that Tony Blair played a huge outsized role, which he played in the Northern Ireland Peace Agreement, and Witkoff, Trump's real estate, as you said, real estate mate.
So he was appointed by Trump as the Middle East envoy. He also got sent off to Russia. A lot of people
He looked like a bit of a dud with sitting there with Putin, you've got to say.
Had no real foreign policy expertise, but this kind of real estate negotiator, hard man from New York, that, okay, Trump supporters said, look, this is the type of character you need for dealing with some of these intractable problems. And it must be said, he hasn't done this on his own. Jared Kushner's been sent in as well, so Trump's son-in-law that was the Middle East envoy in the first Trump administration. He's been working, as we understand it, with Tony Blair in recent months, formulating the specifics of a proposal. Mm. Now, that's not what is this 20-point peace plan, but certainly elements of that are in that plan. And it would seem that the elements of the Saudi-French peace plan are included in these 20 points. And I think what we should acknowledge is that these talks taking place in Sharm el-Sheikh have included the Egyptians, the Turkish, the Qataris, all of whom Trump is paying tribute to, as well as pretty much all the other world leaders. So we can't ignore that they've played.
And I was particularly, because I mean, one of the things I said on our last big drop, which was last weekend, was where are the Arab leaders speaking out, you know, overtly, not just behind the scenes. Now, I have to accept that they have apparently been working absolutely round the clock, the Turks and the Egyptians in particular and the Qataris.
And for all of that, Iran blessing this agreement. Offering its blessing.
Yes. Well, what does that mean? I mean, what does it mean? I'm just going to pause for a moment.
Yeah.
Well, yes, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to pause because I'm not quite sure what that all means. Look, I think it is very interesting. Part of the negotiations have been around how far it would appear, how far the IDF does withdraw from parts of Gaza City, and that's a very important bit, and what prisoners are released from Israel. Now, there is a chance that Marwan Barghouti, who is the long-standing Palestinian leader, highly regarded by many as the sort of the last major potential leader standing.
Well, likely successor to Mahmoud Abbas. That's the preferred option.
That's the preferred option. But he was in prison for years for five consecutive sentences. Now, that'll be very interesting to see whether he is one of the people released.
Because there will be, in effect, an exchange. So the hostages will be released. There's 20 that are believed to be alive. There's 25 bodies that will also be delivered.
And they're not entirely sure where they all are, apparently.
And the timing of the dead hostages being handed back seems less clear. So the immediate delivery would be the living hostages. In return, the Israelis would be releasing 250 Palestinians serving life sentences, as well as 1,700 Gazans who have been jailed by Israel during this period of conflict.
Yes, and it was another very interesting fact about these long negotiations that have just taken place. There was Hamas there and members of the Islamic Jihad and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. And one of the interpretations was that Hamas was actually ensuring that they took part in the deal.
Well, because they needed these groups, because some of those groups hold the hostages.
I mean, to me, it was a very interesting sign that Hamas is hemmed in, as I was saying the other day, and wants to get this done. Now, can I list you the questions I made to myself when I went down there and was reading all about it? Who will supervise the withdrawal of the IDF? I don't know whether that's been decided yet. What Arab countries are committing their troops? I still haven't got to the bottom of that. Who will be in charge of the governing council, or whatever it's called, the Board of Peace? Who will choose the Palestinian technocrats? Who their statement is that it's going to be a group possibly up to 5 years of Palestinian technocrats. Who will supervise the resumption of aid? I mean, that is crucially important.
Well, it is the UN, though. That's part of this 20-point peace plan, is that the UN will take responsibility for the delivery of aid.
Okay, all right. Well, that's one answer. That's very interesting. So, you know, there's a lot of... Not that I'm citing this as meaning it could all fall apart, but it is very interesting to compare and contrast the Good Friday Agreement in 1998 on Northern Ireland, in which, of course, was governed by Blair, who was told, I might add, when he first came in as a young Prime Minister, he said, oh, you know, want to look at Northern Ireland. They said, no, Prime Minister, too hard, impossible to solve. And he did, you know, he got in there and did it. So I think it's just very interesting to imagine who's going to be the solid force in there that... basically goes through the setbacks that will occur. Because what is fascinating about the Northern Ireland one is that even when you had agreements like today, there were terrible setbacks, like bombs, for instance. Apparently John Major, who was the head of the UK Prime Minister, was furious with Clinton, who was obviously President Clinton, for inviting the Sinn Féin leader, Gerry Adams, to America, which turned out to be a masterstroke, because the IRA was still bombing. But the agreement went ahead. It may be in fits and starts, but it went ahead. That's why I think today is so exciting.
Oh, unquestionably there will be setbacks. None of this is certain. None of these things are real until they actually happen. So as we're talking on Thursday afternoon, just to set out the timeline for listeners, if you're listening here in Australia, Thursday afternoon, evening, 8 p.m. Australian Eastern Time tonight is when the agreement should be signed in Egypt. 11 p.m. Eastern Time here is when Israel's cabinet will vote to ratify it. And then midnight our time is when the Israeli parliament would vote and ratify the agreement. And that's the point at which the ceasefire would go live, as it were. So as we understand it, the IDF will withdraw to an agreed line. It's not the initially published line, as I understand it. There was some negotiation and adjustment around that. From what I'm reading, the IDF will still be in control of something like 40% of Gaza's territory. Interestingly, none of the wording in the recent hours refers at all to Hamas's arms. So if you remember when we spoke on the weekend, the language had changed from Steve Witkoff, the US envoy, from disarmament to decommissioning of weapons. There's now no mention of weapons at all. I think the other thing to note is that Trump will chair this Board of Peace. That we do know.
For how long?
He has said there will be other world leaders on this board, including Tony Blair. The technocrats, the Palestinian technocrats, I think are interesting because this excludes for the time being the Palestinian Authority. And I think the complaint that I've read about and heard from Palestinian quarters in all of this is that the concern is that this has separated, it's disaggregated the Gaza question from the West Bank question. And when you think about what Israel's been doing with settlements in the West Bank, the fragility of the Palestinian Authority, the questions about the future of Mahmoud Abbas and whether they can actually get themselves ready to hold elections, I think it is important to note at this juncture that these arrangements, this settlement, does not treat Gaza and the West Bank as part of a single Palestinian entity.
No, not at all. And but look, it was never going to. You know what I mean? I think that they had to get Gaza settled one way or the other. And I think of them as quite different.
You might, but I think these drawing of lines in particular moments of history can shape what happens next for many, many years.
Yes.
And I think we can't ignore that, particularly when it comes to the Middle East. Think about the Sykes-Picot line. These arrangements that are arrived at in the moment because they make sense can have far-reaching consequences. And so I'm not predicting anything, I'm not pointing to anything specific, but I'm just saying take note of the fact that at this moment it sort of decouples Gaza from the West Bank.
Yes, look, it's good to it's right to do that, but there was no way they were going to get anywhere near, like, to get something on the table to stop the fighting. You know, there was no way they could tackle that West Bank at the moment, I don't think. And, you know, I just think it's going to be, the politics of Israel are going to be now fascinating.
Well, I mean, obviously, it'd be fascinating to see the way the likes of Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich, the far right members of Netanyahu's cabinet, the way they react to this, I think will be worth looking at. Whether or not, in fact, Netanyahu can keep his government together in delivering this ceasefire and the subsequent arrangements. I mean, it's hard to imagine even the conversation that's happening within the cabinet around the release of some of these Palestinian prisoners that the Israelis hold, particularly the likes of Marwan Barghouti and others.
Remembering that they actually released Sinwar in a previous release years ago after, I think, the Second Intifada, who ended up, of course, being the orchestrator of October the 7th.
Yeah, so I think as well it's worth just touching on the human side to this story, right? There are the remaining population of Gaza that have been living with this bloodshed for the last 2 years. This comes, you know, 2 years and a day, essentially, since the October 7 attacks. This comes 2 years since those hostages, those Israeli hostages, were taken and have been held, we believe, in the tunnels underneath Gaza, their families, their communities, their loved ones. This is a profound human moment as well, and obviously for all of the geopolitics of this and the extraordinary international dynamics, there are individual lives at stake here. There are people's hopes, people's relationships. Can you imagine the desire of some of the families? I was just reading the comments from the sister of a Nepalese hostage that's been held for 2 years, a Nepalese family. Has been caught up in this. Can you imagine the sense of anguish they've lived through, but also that desire to hold out their hand and to touch their daughter, their sister, their loved one?
It is, you know, frankly, beyond my full imagination. In fact, I listened to a podcast this week with Al Sharabi, who had been held for 491 days, and his book is Hostage, which is a huge bestseller. It's just come out in English, actually. And it was fascinating listening to him. What an amazing man. He just refused to be seen as a victim. So he had an incredible character. And he said, what kept me going was that Viktor Frankl line from Man's Search for Meaning. You can cope with any how as long as you understand the why. It's just such a line. And he kept himself alive. He's got his older brother is one of the dead men whom they will have to get out his body. He's got a young man who became like an adopted son, Alon, forgotten his surname. He's desperate to see him. But it was an incredible account of how you survive, how you keep your head in order and emerge whole, well, half whole anyway.
And we started this emergency episode by talking about those images, those scenes in Gaza of people dancing in the street. Just think about what this moment's like for those kids who've been living through this conflict for 2 years. The children born.
Well,
in those hospitals,
so many who lost
under siege.
Parents, you know, like so many of them are on their own. Honestly, you can hardly bear to think about it.
The families that have moved as large groupings from one supposed safe point to another during this conflict because they've been told that that's where they need to go to be safe. The people that have considered the prospect of death by sending a family member out to get food from some of these food distribution points so controversially established outside of the populated areas for people to go to, but which led to the deaths, the shooting deaths of so many Palestinian civilians seeking food. Can you imagine what this day is like for them as they, you know, imagine the promise, you know, that they are seeing and hearing the same news that we are, Donald Trump promising this bright future. You know, you've often talked about, we've talked about the possibility of hope and
that's
the need
right,
for that.
The vital need for hope. I did smile to myself, peace in the Middle East, he said, who would have thought it? Well, you don't talk, in my opinion, you don't talk like that about the Middle East because it doesn't conform to that neat summary. You talk about, you know, this decision about this particular stage. But it is a really, I suppose we just really, really do hope that the people who have got the ability to cut through and keep on it, because it'll have to be dogged perseverance. That is the only way the Northern Irish thing was changed.
Was delivered.
It was delivered.
And some unconventional characters like Mo Mollem.
Indeed,
Who was the Northern Ireland secretary. She had a brain tumour, it turned out, at the time, and led to some pretty strange behaviour in some of the meetings and negotiations. She was very frank. She was very direct. She broke convention. Do you remember she got out of the car and walked around when she was there on one of her initial visits?
And people like Martin McGuinness from the IRA and Ian Paisley from the unions became the best of friends. So there were extraordinary developments in that. In fact, I must commend to people, if you care to look it up, a woman called Megan Stack, who was a young journalist in Northern Ireland. I think she's Northern Irish. She wrote a very good piece in the New York Times earlier this week comparing and contrasting what happened then with what is happening now. She said, you know, you can't overdraw the overlaps, but there are some incredible ones. And our own Rear Vision has got a special this weekend. They've gone back to a program they did in 2018 on the 20th anniversary of the Good Friday Accords just to look at the comparisons in a way or to sort of remind us of what exists when you're trying to end wars that look intractable. Because they can be ended. Mm. We must believe that.
Maybe that's a good point to end it. We'll drop our main episode into the feed this week on Japan. We're going to introduce you to Japan's new hardline first ever female prime minister, who is quite a character. There's quite a story there. You can catch that on Radio National as well on Saturday morning. I thought maybe I'd leave you with the comment of Mark Carney, the Canadian prime minister, because I think he sort of summed it up very well. After years of intense suffering, peace finally feels attainable. I suppose that's the point.
That's the golden search, and it's marvellous to be part of today, to at least be able to consider some part in the journey.
global.roaming@abc.net.au is our email address. Always love to hear from you on this or any of our other topics. Thanks to our producer, Taryn Priyadko, Geraldine. We'll leave you to it.
Bye-bye.